This is Annie.
Hi, Annie. How are you?
Good.
Thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, happy to do it.
So I'll have a tiny little intro.
Okay.
And then we'll go right into it. Is that cool?
Yeah.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Hashtag Pooligans podcast. Today, we're lucky enough to be joined by yet another fan favorite of POTUS Press Pool and Reporters Roundtable fame. She's currently a national reporter focused on the 2020 presidential campaign for the Washington Post. And every self-respecting hashtag Pooligan, of course, already follows her on Twitter at Annie Linsky. Annie, welcome.
Hi there.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah.
So we'll start as we have been starting these things, because one of the points of doing these podcasts with POTUS Press Pool favorites is to get to know why do people go into journalism and why in journalism politics. So could you tell us when and in what order did journalism and politics strike you as something that you wanted to do for a living?
Well, I mean, I have to say, in terms of getting into journalism, I was dating a journalist, and his job seemed like a lot of fun. So that was when I began to think this would be a good idea, and I would try doing it. But my first few, you know, a lot of people do this in college, and that's often a good way to get into it if you're sort of wise enough to work for your college newspaper. But I didn't, and so I had to freelance for a while to get clips in order to present to reputable news organizations. So I did probably spend maybe 6 months freelancing, and it was tough. I mean, I was doing, some of the stories that I worked on, I've been thinking back on them. I worked for, I guess, called some sort of government weekly magazine, but they paid like 50 cents a word.
Wow.
Which was a lot. So I was really like always eager to pay for, to work for them, and was like pitching these random, like, bureaucratic type stories. But I got my big break when the Baltimore Sun needed somebody in their book review section. And so I started, that was my first full-time job in journalism, was working in this tiny book review section at the Baltimore Sun, helping put the book pages together. They called it the Book Nook. That's where I started.
Do you remember any book that you reviewed for the Book Nook?
Well, I was not able initially to actually review the books. I was doing a lot, like, way, you know, I was more like unpacking the books that were sent in and
the glamorous
and
stuff, really, the fun
really
stuff.
Glamorous stuff, right? You know, emailing the reviewers to like remind them to get the review in. I think at one point, like months and months into this job, I was finally asked to review a book, and it was by Carl Hiaasen. It was a book that he had written, and so he's sort of a humor writer, and it was, a lot of his books are based out of Florida, and I'd never read a Carl Hiaasen book before, but I think I was assigned the book review because like nobody else on staff wanted to do it, because Carl's brother Rob Hiaasen worked for the Baltimore Sun at the time.
Uh-oh.
And so nobody wanted to, like, you know, just get in the middle of their relationship and either like write a really good review, which I think, I don't remember what the relationship was at the time between Carl and his brother, but as there often is in journalism, there's some competition. So I read it, and I just kind of hated it. Like, I just didn't like the book
no.
at all.
Oh, no.
I know. I was super worried about it. I was super worried that, like, Rob was going to be annoyed. But it turned out that I think he was, like, kind of, like, okay that somebody was, like, I think at the end of the day, it turned out to be fine. He was just, like, fine that somebody was not super happy with his brother's book. But it was nice. I did get to know him a little bit. And as I'm sure you know and your listeners know, Rob ended up working at the Annapolis Capitol and was killed, last year around this time. So I do think back on how gracious he was about my negative review of his brother's book. So anyway, that was my entree to journalism and meeting a lot of great journalists.
Did you also do crime at the Baltimore
Sun? Yeah. So pretty quickly. Well, so the Baltimore Sun is still owned by the Tribune Company, and not too long after I started, they realized that they could save money by just like getting rid of the book review section altogether. So, like, the first of many of the jobs I've done that have been like eliminated immediately after I was hired. So they didn't really know what to do with me. and eventually kind of sent me out to the Annapolis, the Anne Arundel County Bureau, which was in Annapolis, Maryland. And they had me do, and this is like a very hybrid beat that I don't think has ever existed anywhere else in the country, but I did crime and sailing.
Crime and sailing. Are those three? This sounds like Miami Vice. This sounds fantastic.
I know. It was. There were a few times when the crime and sailing beat overlapped, which was sort of great for me. Like a boat, there'd be a fire on a boat, and I'd be like, oh, wow. Get a sailing column out of this crime story I'm working on. But yeah, I covered crime. In Anne Arundel County. And it was such a different time. One of the first stories I wrote actually when I was on the crime beat was crazy. There's an unarmed, naked black man who was shot to death by a police officer. And so it was just like the man was naked. I mean, there's no possible way he had a weapon, you know. And I remember the lead of the story was just like, you know, and it was one of the first police involved shootings I had ever covered. And I just remember being so completely shocked by it. And, you know, I began really thinking about this case when the Black Lives Matter movement began to really take steam in 2016, because I just remember thinking, wow, I am really glad that there is this kind of anger that's erupting around the country for many of these incidents. And having seen them close up, I remember thinking, my God, this is just amazing and terrible. And it didn't even get on the front page of the newspaper. And I remember being, you know, a really young reporter and just furious that this story wasn't on the front page, and I couldn't get it on the front page. And I did, like, you know, I did so much, you know, these stories, you do a crime story and often there's just a story when it happens and then it just sort of, you know, fades away. And I would go and talk to the family, and the family was really just, I mean, they were obviously devastated, but they just felt so resigned that this is just the way it is. And that was also just heartbreaking to me. And I think about them a lot, that it was one of the first stories I did out there. And I just, you know, I just remember trying and trying and trying and wanting so badly for it to be on the front page. And so much has changed now. I mean, if that had happened now, I think the reaction would be very different. And it wouldn't matter also, quite frankly, now if it had been on the front page or not. I mean, it wasn't like completely before the internet, but it was before Twitter. It was before social media. And it was before there was sort of a way for these stories to be shared more widely. But so that was like one of the early ones. I got better at getting things on the front page later in my career, but that was one that I definitely didn't.
Many people complain about Twitter and all of the horrible things that social media does. But like you're saying, that actually might be a story that would have benefited. Say you could not get that for whatever reason, editorially speaking, on the front page today, then Twitter and social media probably would get it on the front page eventually.
Yeah. I mean, it is the thing when you do complain about Twitter a lot. But in this case, I really think it would have helped.
Did you stick with the crime reporting for a while, or was that a sort of?
So I did. I was a crime reporter, which is a great beat covering crime. I did it in Anne Arundel County for a while, and then I was moved downtown, which when working for a big city daily newspaper, that was a big deal when you're like moved out of the suburbs to cover. You know, to cover crime downtown and in Baltimore, crime, it's like, and I thought of it at least as like the premier beat. Like I thought about how like in Hollywood, if you're a reporter in LA, you want to be covering the entertainment industry, or like in Washington, D.C., you want to be covering national politics. But like crime in Baltimore, it's always been like literally what the city does the most of, which is awful to say, I realize. Wow. But it's true. I mean, it's true now more than it even was then. But but so it was a big deal, right? You're going down to cover crime. And I joined a team of, there were two people covering the police department, one person covering courts, one person city courts, one person covering federal courts. I think it was a team of five people covering crime just in Baltimore City. So I was kind of the lowest person on the totem pole, and the sort of sub you know, I was under the second tier police reporter. So I ended up covering fires a lot, which is like considered like very low, you know. It's just like, all right, there's a fire, you gotta go run out.
I wasn't aware that there was a ranking among the,
there's a ranking
among the crime reporters.
Yep. I was fire. And then I also was criminals, because the other person on the crime beat was like really well sourced in the police department. So like, you know, he didn't really want me like edging in and, you know, getting to know the, you know, police commissioner. That was sort of his area. So I got to know like the criminals, which was a wild.
Good job, Annie.
Yeah. Some of my really good sources actually were criminals, and it was terrifying. It's especially in retrospect, because I was on federal wires, I later learned. But they would call me and they would complain about a number of things. They would get locked up and they would complain about prison type, you know, things in prisons. And but they were it was very helpful to have a source inside a city prison, because there would be riots and then we would get another view about you know, what would happen. And they also often knew a lot about crimes that were happening in the city, and they would tell me things that were either reportable or helped me with my reporting. But it was a very awkward position to be in. But covering the police department, covering the fire department was fascinating. One of the early things that I covered was a live burn exercise, where the fire department in Baltimore City was like, they were burning down. They were doing live burn exercises in Baltimore City in vacant row houses, and it was a terrible idea. They shouldn't have been doing it, and a cadet died at one point. It was awful. It was tragic and awful. But what became even more horrifying was I FOIA'd the city documents, and like the fire, you know, top fire department people had asked the city, like, oh, hey, we've got these vacant buildings, we'd like to do a live burn exercise. And the city had said, no, you can't do it, because it's not safe to light a building on fire in the city. And the department did it anyway. I'd sit at my desk and just want to like slam my head against the desk, because it's just how like the fire department was like actually in writing told, please don't burn down one of our buildings. And the fire department was like, no, 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 we got this. We're going to just do it anyway. So that was, you know, one of many sort of, you know, disasters that I covered. But you just, you know, so you get to know some of the terrible parts of a city, but then you also get to know these heroes. And there were people in Baltimore city government that were just, you know, understandably really upset by the way the department was behaving, and they really wanted to get the word out. And, you know, when you're working at a local paper, especially the Sun at the time, people would just come to me and they'd be like, okay, you've got to do this. And I got so much guidance from, you know, actually fire unions, and just city officials who are just like, you know, beside themselves when this type of thing happened, and we're trying to just, you know, get the information out so that things would change. And the fire commissioner left. I mean, he ended up resigning after that particular episode. So, and the victim's family was just really, I mean, it was this type of thing where she, the woman who died, the fire cadet who died, I mean, the family, of course, was so devastated, but they were really glad. I remember talking to family members, and they were just happy, not happy, but they respected, they wanted information to come out. They wanted to know what had happened and what had gone wrong, and like exactly what had gone wrong. And I'm glad that the paper provided some answers for them. And so it was very rewarding work.
Did you grow up in Baltimore, Annie?
No, I grew up in Connecticut. I just sort of ended up, kind of randomly with this paper having a position and hiring me. But I spent 9 years there, so it was a lot. I got to know it. I feel like I know it very well. I did politics because I ended up working. They moved me to City Hall, and the mayor was under indictment, so it was kind of like I was still covering crime.
Best of both worlds.
I know. I was all excited to be covering, you know, finally covering politics, which I'd always wanted to do. And they were like, well, you know, you've done such a good job as a crime reporter and the mayor's being investigated. So if you can kind of focus on that area. And I was like, oh. But I was excited about, you know, doing something else for a little while. But at least it wasn't, you know, people getting killed. It was a little like it was different. A different kind of crime that I was covering.
Move to the white collar crime.
Right, exactly. Right. Yes. There's a little bit less, you know, it certainly was, there were a lot less, there's less heartache involved. It was still, you know, violations of public trust, but those, although can be damaging to the democracy, it doesn't even compare to, you know, walking up to a victim's family when somebody has been killed.
So when you, once you started covering politics at The Sun, how long was it before you moved on? So you were there for 9 years at The Sun and then you moved on.
Oh yeah. Well, The Sun, I really loved that paper, but you just sort of ran out of positions to do there. I mean, they just were really being squeezed by their corporate ownership. So I got a job at Bloomberg News and went to work there for a while. I was in Boston for about a year, and then they moved me down to Washington to cover politics. And I got to do, like, that's where, you know, I got to meet Julie that way. I covered the White House for Bloomberg for a little while, which is a great deal of fun. I mean, you know, covering the White House for Bloomberg News is just, it's a really, really fun job. So I got to do that for a little while. And then ended up going to the Boston Globe, where I was for 4 years in D.C. covering the 2016 campaign.
And the 2016 campaign, of course, one of those low-key affairs that nobody really remembers well.
Right.
And you wrote a couple of pieces while at the Globe that also got some interesting attention. Particularly one about Clinton, where I think you reported justly that during an appearance at a Boys and Girls Club event, she perhaps did not respond in the most personable manner.
So the Globe, I was covering Democrats for the Boston Globe, and I was up following Secretary Clinton around and in New Hampshire, and I was trying to get at this idea that she was having trouble connecting. So that was when I was doing the story, I was kind of looking for examples of that. And it's, I think in journalism, it's always a little difficult to write about something that's not happening. You know, we write about things that are happening. So, you know, this was a little bit of a tricky story, and I wasn't entirely sure I would end up writing that story because it's hard to do. But, you know, there I was in New Hampshire, and, I had an opioid town hall, and these various people were telling a story, you know, were standing up telling these just awful stories about their loved ones, about addiction, about death. And it was really a very solemn affair. And there were, you know, points at which even the kind of very, like, you know, the reporters in the back of the room were moved by what people were saying, because it was just a very intense personal, you know, it was a day that was intense and personal, and the event certainly was. And at one point, a person stood up and told this heartbreaking story about a relative who died after being addicted to opioids. And I was just watching, and Secretary Clinton just sort of like backed away, and she said, "Oh, thank you for the story," and then kind of pitched the answer to somebody else. And there was just not at all the connection and the warmth that people would say that the secretary displayed privately was just completely missing. And I, you know, I just remember thinking, oh my goodness, you know, her husband would have handled that question differently. You know, Vice President Biden, who was thinking of getting in the race, I believe at the time, would have handled it differently. You know, so sort of like a, you know, a mayor of Baltimore would have handled that question differently. So there's a tape recording of it, or a video recording of it, I believe. I remember watching a few times afterwards just to make sure that my recollection was right. And so that ended up being the lead of a story about how she was having, you know, she was missing those moments. where people were just looking for a connection and a walking away to feeling a certain way rather than, you know, yes, she had a policy prescription that was detailed and undoubtedly would have been helpful in that situation. But I think sometimes, you know, politics is about how you feel and that's what's remembered rather than, you know, what's said. So I tried to get at that. But it didn't make me a popular reporter in the sort of Clinton press shop. So
it struck me as a particularly interesting story when I did sort of my due diligence for today's interview, because within the realm of our podcast, we've had several people who've known Hillary Clinton personally. And mm-hmm. some of them who've known her socially, I should say, and some who've known her professionally.
Yeah.
And there seems to be the exact chasm that you were getting at, where people who know her socially said she's warm, she's funny, she's kind. And people who knew her professionally were like, yeah, but not professionally, though. That is where frequently that just simply did not translate.
Yeah.
I think that was the observation that article was trying to get across and did.
Yeah, it was, you know, I would talk to so many people in 2016 who'd say exactly those things. She's warm, she's generous, she's kind, she remembers your birthday, she writes a note when somebody in your family dies. And that's all, you know, those are all, you know, wonderful attributes of, mm-hmm. of a friend. But whenever I'd follow up and say, okay, well, give me an example of her warmth, or tell me about, you know, what this like delightful sense of humor, give me an example of it. It would just be like, well, she's just so warm. And then I'd be like, okay, well, like what, you know, specifically how? And it'd be like, it's just, I can't, there's just too many.
There's excessive warmness. I cannot even pick one example due to the excessiveness of the warmness.
And I was like, well, please, please, you know, and so, I mean, that's where you just want there to be some detail to fill in. And again, I don't doubt the veracity of it. You do hear it from so many people, but nobody was willing. I could not find people who were willing to share anecdotes about that, aside from somebody wrote me a letter when X happened. And you do, you know, in this role, you do realize that, you know, I mean, I'm looking right now at my desk. Terry McAuliffe wrote me a letter after we had a dinner. And so it's like, it's nice. And it's warm. It's a touching thing to do. But to me, that's sort of a standard, you know, that tells you something about how he operates as a politician rather than, you know, than anything else. And you find other politicians where you ask that question. I think, you know, Elizabeth Warren is one where there are a number of examples of things that you can point to that she does sort of semi-privately that reinforce this notion that she's kind of has these qualities of warmth. And I tried so hard, but I could never pull them out of the Clinton friends. I mean, I wish that if they're there, I wish I had been able to. But people weren't seeing that. So
it's interesting actually that you mentioned Warren. I'm curious what you observed with Clinton. You wrote a really interesting piece in January, I thought, about how the current female candidates are having to deal with this idea of, hi, I'm not Hillary. Please realize that I'm totally not her, right? Meanwhile, Biden is running around going, I'm such a fan of Obama and we loved each other so much. The vast discrepancy between the two messages seems only to have increased since you wrote that piece in, I think it was January.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that piece now?
You know, I feel good about it. I think that I remember having this sense. I wrote it right after Warren got into the race, and there were these comparisons between Warren and Hillary Clinton, and all of a sudden people were saying, "Oh, she reminds me of Hillary Clinton," mm-hmm. and I was just like, "Oh my goodness, she's nothing like Hillary Clinton." Like I mean, both are very accomplished women, but they are very different, and they had up until the point in which Elizabeth Warren rose her hand and said, "I'd like to run for president." Suddenly, there was this sort of movement that these are two women who are about the same age and they're both blonde and they're therefore the same. And, you know, their backgrounds are so different. Their paths through life are so different. And, you know, and I would say two brilliant, that another similarity is they're both very intelligent. And you're sort of certainly with, and I've had more exposure to Warren, but you certainly do have the sense that she is, you know, the smartest person in most of the rooms that she's in. But their approaches and their policies and the way that they've kind of moved through life are just polar opposite. So I was struck by that, and I began to wonder, oh my goodness, is every single woman who gets into the race going to have this, are they going to have to basically beat Hillary Clinton before they win the nomination if a woman does? And I think that has held true. I mean, Kirsten Gillibrand being a woman from female senator from New York, you certainly hear people saying like, oh, do we need another female senator from New York? You know, and mm-hmm. it's like, she's more than a female senator from New York. And, you know, just because they happen to occupy the same space, does that mean that they're the same? And so people would pick like parts of Hillary Clinton's, you know, campaign and just sort of project that as the entirety onto these other women who are running. But I do think that there is, you know, one of the things that's really amazing and rewarding about covering 2020 is there are six women in the race. And I think that that is going to go down as one of them. It's just an enormous change, you know, and of those six, you know, four of them are sitting U.S. senators. So I think that is eroding a little bit this notion that every woman running for president is Hillary Clinton or is just like Hillary mm-hmm. Clinton. You know, they're being able to carve out their own identities. And in terms of Obama, you know, I mean, Biden is tying himself to Obama. And I think people like to talk about Obama because he won, you know, and so that's a good thing if you're a Democrat and he's popular. But I have been really interested in this notion that a lot of these 2020 candidates are not running on Obamaism. They are saying that they want to do different things than Obama on, you know, everything from trade to healthcare, to labor issues, to the environment, you know, they're offering to immigration is another one where there are certainly candidates saying they want to go in a different direction. And I think that's interesting. I mean, it does get to this other issue, which is how much the party has changed just even since 2008. And there has been a shift, not only among the activists, but the candidates are reflecting that shift to the left. And so, you know, and with Biden, he's saying, you know, I suppose Castro is sort of saying this too, but Biden's certainly the most prominent person saying he wants to go back. It just turn back, go back and be the third term of Obama. And there are some areas where he's saying he should build on what Obama did. But that's sort of the message of the message of his campaign is let's just turn back. Let's go back to 2016 and redo things. And the person in office could be replaced by me and we'll be returned to sort of a normalcy that we're used to.
Has that actually come out of Biden camp people's mouths that's what it is? It's like a little time machine back to happier times?
They're not quite saying time machine, but they are saying that the problem, the diagnosis, what's wrong with the country right now is the man who's sitting in the Oval Office. Mm-hmm. And if you get rid of him, there's a lot that can be done to just a lot goes away. A lot of the problems, the divisiveness, the just some of the rhetoric that has stirred up ugly things in the United States will, much of that will be gone and cleared away. And you don't need to think about like what's going to be on your Twitter feed every day, because you'll have a person in the White House in Joe Biden who is responsible and decent and brings back some of these attributes of Obama that Democrats particularly missed. But then there are other candidates, you know, Elizabeth Warren is one, Pete Buttigieg is another, who are saying, no, you know, Trump is a symptom of deeper problems in the country, and we would fix those deeper problems, and we would use our candidacy to fix those deeper problems. So that is a really stark divide in approach that we're seeing play out in the kind of the early phases of the campaign.
We've had these discussions on this podcast sort of in the reverse with Tim Miller and Doug High. We talked about, is there going to be rubber banding for the GOP sort of on the other side of flip side of that coin? And I think both are rather suspicious of this idea that there will be rubber banding on the GOP. And conversely, on the Dem side, that's a really interesting divide between the two, that one thinks that we can just, you know, the sort of the head of the snake controls right. the rest of the body, whereas the rest seems to be concerned that that is, in fact, similarly to what the GOP operative said, that they don't really feel that that is necessarily the case.
Right. Yeah. And it'll to me, that'll be quite like, that's one of the kind of questions that I like to ask voters is like, do you think there's something deeper wrong here? Like, are you looking for a deeper changes? Or is it just like, I am exhausted by this administration. I am exhausted by what I hear on the news, what I read. I can't take another, you know, another cycle of tumultuous change. And can we just all hit pause for 4 years or 8 years?
So what do those voters tell you? Do you sense any sort of trend, or does it depend
Does it
depend on whose candidates voters you're talking to?
You hear it kind of mixed up, because there are a lot of Democratic voters and just, you know, voters in general who are curious about this race, who are trying to get to lots and lots of events. So
sure.
if you're at a Biden event, you're not necessarily, and it's
talking
interesting.
To a Biden voter. Yeah.
You're not. There's a lot of people who are just saying, look, I think it's my responsibility to just hear as many people. So you would think like, oh, okay, I'm going to a Biden event. It's going to be a bunch of the rah-rah hardcore Biden folks, but it's not necessarily, I mean, certainly there are people there who are really excited by him. And there are people who afterwards are like, oh, wow, I wasn't expecting to be so excited. And now I am. But there's also this bunch of people who are like, look, I'm seeing as many as possible. And, you know, I'm really gonna wait. And so you can actually go and find an undecided voter at these events, which is unusual. I mean, you know, usually it is just like the diehards who come out. But now it's like, you know, this sort of vast array, but it really runs the gamut. One of the things that I think in terms of voter questions is most interesting and unexpected and almost uniform is when you talk about healthcare and Medicare for all, and this idea that many Democratic candidates are pushing that would, you know, utterly transform the country's healthcare system and potentially what's essentially a single payer healthcare system, where there would not be, you know, under Bernie Sanders's plan, any private insurance companies at all after 2 years. It would kind of transform completely. And I've asked people about that, thinking like, all right, so do you really want to get rid of all private insurance companies? And people, that's the one area where people are like, yes. I mean, yes, I've got private insurance and it's been terrible. And literally everybody has a story. Everybody has a story about how much they hate it. So that's one of the areas I think for me in talking to voters that I've been most surprised by. It's just like story after story after story of just like nightmarish experiences with people who are insured. These aren't even people who aren't insured, people who are.
When you talk to people at those events, do a lot of people talk to you about impeachment, about Mueller report, about what's going on with the president, or do most of them want to talk to you about things like healthcare that they care about?
It's really things like healthcare. I mean, I think that you're one of the things, the commonality of these events, even if it's not, because I've gone out to see a number of these candidates across the country, and you know, the commonality, interestingly, as we were saying earlier, it isn't like I am the biggest Beto O'Rourke fan, or I'm the biggest Elizabeth Warren fan, or I'm the biggest Pete Buttigieg fan. Like, the one commonality is they all really don't like the president, and they are all very, very motivated to get rid of him and to get him out of office. And so it's almost like they all have the same, they all have a similar level of I guess what I would call disgust toward him. So you don't, you know, it's sort of, they think it's a given that he should either be impeached, or that the Mueller report shows that he did terrible things, and that you know, they're all coming from the same place there. So they don't even really talk about it that much. So they talk about more about like that's kind of a given once you walk into these, many of these events. And so they're kind of on to the next phase, which is, okay, how do we, like, we're definitely going to replace him. That's the view of we definitely want to replace him, but like, which option should we pick? And so that's where the discussion is among the options that are available for him, and the views of candidates who would be, you know, who would be the potential options. So, you know, I am very struck by that, because you would think you're walking into, I mean, if you want to have that debate, I think people would be willing to engage in it, but it's not sort of where their mindset is, the audience's mindset is when you walk into these events.
So maybe that's another difference between the Twitter crowd and the actual crowd that shows up at these events.
Yeah. Well, there's already sort of a consensus, I think. I think that's sort of why it's like there's not going to be a debate over whether it should happen or whether it shouldn't. There's more of a consensus that we really just want to move on from this precedent. And, you know, that will be something to monitor, too, like how long that intensity can last. I mean, it really has lasted a lot longer than I would have guessed. But it does seem like the president continues to do things that stir it up again and again. And, you know, of whether he's doing that to get his base excited, he is also sort of the inverse is happening too, which kind of with each one of these waves of outrage, it isn't so far, at least I haven't seen it sort of dying down in terms of making the Democratic side upset.
I think that's a really, really great point, that president seems to have a talent for re-infuriating the exhausted in a way that seems almost improbable.
Yeah, you're right. It really does. I mean, you think that, wow, I mean, and there is this fatigue, but at least among the people who are going to these events, it's sort of motivating them to go rather than prompting them not, than making them just decide to stay home. Mm-hmm.
To get back really quickly to something that we said earlier about the female candidates, because I feel like the female candidates are still not really getting the amount of press that the male candidates are getting. So how about if we just go quickly through these female candidates and tell me a little bit which one of those, and I know that journalism is not really prognosticating, so I apologize for that part of the question. Who do we think stands a reasonable chance of breaking out and of making it onto the big stage?
Sure.
Who do you see that happening for?
Let's just start with Senator Warren, who, if you believe early polls, which we're trying not to believe, but there's what's interesting about her is she gets into the race probably at her lowest popularity in the last 6 or 7 years. I mean, she did kind of come into the race at a very difficult time. And what she has shown, which is impressive and distinct from other candidates, is sort of an ability to, she's very popular in like August of last year, and then it took a dive with her sort of DNA release. But she's shown so far that she's been able to change the narrative about herself, and her sort of consistent rolling out of various plans has become her brand, which is it's very authentic to her. She does think about big policy issues in different ways, in ways that are not, and this is her campaign message, it's not about small bites. I mean, she is talking about like massive changes to the economy or to government or to lobbying to various industries, and that's very much become her brand. And you've seen her poll numbers go from going down to going up, and that's a big deal to be able to, as a candidate, not just collapse. She's shown that she has an operation and that they've just sort of stayed true to, and you've seen the narrative about her campaign change. And I think, that's a very impressive thing. Like, she's sort of dealt with a crisis. She's dealt with crises and been able to plow through it and come out and it appears on the other side. So I think that it really speaks to the durability of her campaign and what she's built. And so there's certainly, that she definitely will be on the debate stages, and she's going to be in the hunt until next year. So I think there's a sure bet there. There's somebody who will absolutely be there in the caucuses and in New Hampshire. I think Amy Klobuchar, Senator Klobuchar, is somebody who I would say is very undervalued right now. you don't see her doing sky high in the polls at this point, but she's staking out this place where she's a moderate and it is a bit of a stalking horse to Biden. And I think if you particularly see problems with Biden's candidacy, or you see people wanting to look for a moderate who has a slightly different profile than Biden does. She connects very, I've seen her in Iowa, and she connects very well with Iowa voters. She's from, the nearby state of Minnesota. And so she's able to really talk about farm policy, and she has a Midwestern way of connecting with a crowd that is extremely conversational. And I know for some reason in DC, she doesn't have there's not a lot of buzz about her candidacy, but I think the more people who see her in Iowa, particularly if they see her kind of the way that I did in these forums where she's interacting and taking questions from voters, I think that she's one to watch. Senator Harris is another one who I think is assured to be on the debate stage, and she's, built an operation that will absolutely take her through Super Tuesday. Oh, absolutely, I shouldn't say that is on path to take her certainly through Super Tuesday. I keep saying it. Take her through Super Tuesday. You really see her.
She's Super Tuesdaying, damn it. Yes.
She's Super Tuesday. Well, she's going to be there. Yep. I mean, she's from California, so to imagine her not lasting that long would be surprising. And she spent the last month or so focusing more on fundraising. So you have not seen her as much because she's been doing more fundraising to build something to take her through Super Tuesday. I mean, you need money to do that. And her style, like Klobuchar, is also very conversational. I mean, I've seen her a number of times, and you always feel like you're seeing kind of her say something in a way that's fresh. And she has an ability to campaign, I think, that is sets her apart from other candidates. So she's another one to watch. Gillibrand, Christian Gillibrand from the New Senator from New York. I have to say I saw her announcement speech. I haven't seen a lot of her since then. I think she's one who's having a little bit of a harder time breaking through than the others. So we had a good story about her candidacy by my colleague Chelsea Jans in the Washington Post today. So I she's a campaign that I think is going to need to do a little bit of retooling over the summer to figure out exactly how she can connect and build build an audience. I think it was sort of surprising to hear our story pointed out that she's saying to voters, I might not be your first choice and I might not be your second choice, but just I need some support to get on the debate stage. And place that I'm not sure you want to be. So I think that she needs to do a little bit I would imagine you're going to see her doing some retooling. One person that you on the trail you hear a lot about, I'm not sure how well that's translating nationally at this point, is Tulsi Gabbard. She has a really dedicated and very motivated and potentially not large enough, but a following of people who, when they see her, really, really connect with her. And she hasn't been doing a ton of events, which I think, given how strong she is when she does them, is probably something that her campaign will rethink going forward. But she's one that you certainly hear a lot about. I hear a lot from people who have seen her. The people who have actually seen her in person get really excited. She probably needs to be out more and seeing more people in person. And I guess the last one, Marianne Williamson, she's the only one I have not seen. She was sort of known as Oprah's guru, but she does have the support to be on the debate stage. So we'll definitely see more of her at the end of the month. The end of June.
I was about to ask you. For the Washington Post part of this particular interview.
Yeah.
You switched to WAPO. When was it? November.
December. Yep. Yeah.
How has that experience been with the Washington Post? First of all, being at times the intense focus of ire of the president, but also being gifted with one of, for my money, the best White House team there is.
Yeah, absolutely. Really good.
Tell us a little bit about your national team. What size is that now? And And how do you cover something that's so superlative laden as this particular election that's coming up?
Yeah, well, it's been really exciting to be at the Washington Post. The Post hired my colleague, Matt Visor from the Globe around the same time. So it's at least I've had another person to sort of assimilate into the Post with. And he's wonderful, very talented journalist. It's been great. I mean, it's been really, really great. This is an institution that is so, I think the word I like to think of, you know, that to describe the place is just rigorous. It's such a rigorous news organization and so thoughtful. You know, I've been really happy to be here. And my colleagues are just, I mean, they're brilliant, which is great and intimidating, but they're also just so nice. You know, I think that's sort of like the Washington Post model is that you have to be like really, really smart and talented, but then you also have to be nice. When you have some of these giant newsrooms, which this one is, it's really big. There are a lot of people, which is so, so great. I mean, you know, some of the email chains that I'm on, somebody will throw out an idea and then immediately we'll get, you know, 5 or 6 really good thoughts back that kind of can at times provide the backbone of a daily story. And you have this just intense brain trust that's contributing all the time. And that is extremely rewarding. So, you know, and that's not always the case. I mean, sometimes people are sort of jockeying to just, you know, and some of these larger news organizations can end up kind of competing with each other. And that is not the vibe here at all. We're, you know, it's a lovely place to work. So I'm really lucky and I'm really excited. I'm really excited to be here.
How large is your team at this point? And does that, what does it take in order to cover something that is, you know, it's, you know, the most, oh God, whatever superlative you want to use. It's like the most significant, the most decisive, the most divisive, you know, yeah, election of our lifetime and so on and so forth.
So we have on our team, we have, I would say there's about, you know, it's hard to say exactly, but I would say there are about 15 reporters and 5 or 6 editors. And the reason it's hard is there's some people who are kind of, we're sharing with other teams. So you can kind of count it in a lot of different ways. And it's a really good mix of, people's experience and time at the Post and time covering politics versus covering other things. So, what we're really trying to do is try not to to predict what's going to happen. Like none of us have a crystal ball. And I think there's a real effort to make sure that anybody who's sort of suggesting that they have a crystal ball is sort of, you know, there's just not a, we're trying to avoid that. And it can be hard because people always want to know, well, what do you think is going to happen? But we're trying to focus on what is happening rather than what could at some point in the future happen. You know, in that vein, I wrote a story on the front page of today's Washington Post about Biden's sort of lack of campaigning, outwardly campaigning, you know, and why he might be doing that. And you have this Memorial Day weekend where so many candidates are just crisscrossing the country and going out to meet voters. And Biden's campaign is not. And it's, he hasn't been, you know, he's had a fairly light schedule since he got into the race about a month ago, and kind of going forward into June, he's not going to be going to a lot of the big candidate forums where you're going to see other people. And so my story looks at, you know, why is he making that choice? And it's not intended to be a knock on Biden. It's merely intended to say, look, he is making this choice and why, and what are the risks, and what are other people saying, and what does it mean to make a choice like this? And for him, I mean, what can he say? I mean, it could be that some of these events don't matter as much as they have in the past, and he's ahead in the polls. So it's not that his campaign is making a mistake necessarily, but it is something that is happening on the ground and people are talking about it. So we want our readers to know.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting point. We talked about with Isaac DeVere about that too, is how quickly the readers will go from the headline says Biden is not doing something. It immediately goes to knock, knock. It's a knock. They're trying to, look. I think it's important to understand that there needs to be room, obviously, for fair reporting, which I read your story last night. And I think it's a it's a completely fair and interesting story, considering how strong also Biden's connection is to the military.
Yeah.
You would figure that this would be a holiday that would, in a way, I mean, without wanting to exploit it, but would play to his very obvious strengths. And contrary to how you described Secretary Clinton earlier, Vice President Biden definitely has that easy relationship with a crowd, does he not?
He does. I mean, he does have a real ability to connect with people. There's no doubt. Like he's gifted in that way of being able to, you know, he has these authentic connections. But, you know, his campaign has decided in this phase, mm-hmm. we're not going to capitalize on that. We're not going to use that. That's not what we're unfurling at the moment. And so, you know, for us, the idea is we just want to make sure that we point it out so readers understand how these various candidates, how a candidate uses their time is so important. I mean, there are really two things that you have in a campaign, time and money, and you can always raise more money, but time is something that is, you know, there's only so much of it. And so how he's choosing to use it, it is telling that there's a, you know, and it does also mean he's kind of holding his powder. It means that when he does start doing more events, they are going to get covered more brightly. You know, there'll be a brighter light on it because it's going to be, hey, you know, we haven't heard from you in a while. And that can be useful for a campaign to use that to drive something that they really want to say. They will be absolutely sure that gets across, assuming that there's not any sort of mistake, and in which case the mistake is going to get really highly telegraphed because their light is going to be so bright once you start doing more events. And it is interesting. I mean, covering Senator Warren, which I did for a long time at the Globe, you know, she had a long period where she just did not talk to reporters, you know, mm-hmm. and it was really hard. And like, sometimes I'd get her on the phone, but it was a lot of work to do it. And she'd get off the phone almost immediately. It would always be like, there'd always be like a reason she had to get off the phone. She'd be like, Annie, I'm getting into the car, so I've got to get off the phone. Like, well, cell phones, they don't really work that way. Or like, oh,
it's not an elevator, ma'am.
It's not an elevator. I know. But she's really changed. But it was hard. It was hard for that change to happen, and not because she's not smart enough. It's just because, you know, you get out of the practice of answering these questions, and there's muscle memory. So, you know, there is a risk that Biden, once you're in this sort of more protected stance, you have a hard time or it's awkward to get out of it.
Do you think the Sleepy Joe thing is going to stick?
I mean, the president is so good at making this stuff stick. You know, if you had to bet, because if you look back, there aren't a lot of candidates that have been able to get out from under those nicknames. But I do think that the Democratic electorate is becoming more and more suspicious and protective of their candidates and very consciously does not want to let the president define the terms of their contest. So, you know, I think we're in an area where it's a little tricky. Like, it's possible that, because I do hear voters being, you know, very irritated, even if they don't like Biden, or even Biden isn't their first choice. They do not want to hear his, you know, traits being defined by a president who they so viscerally dislike. I mean, where it could hurt him, I suppose, is more along independent voters. Should he be the nominee? And that's something that any of the nominees need to care about, because they won't necessarily have this cushion of voters who are like so motivated to vote against the president.
You mentioned earlier in sort of an aside that while working at the White House, you became aware of one Julie Mason.
I did.
how was that, and how did you experience Ms. Mason then and since she moved to SiriusXM and is doing the POTUS press pool?
Well, she was always the superstar, and both the superstar of the White House pool, but the White House reporters, but also just like one of the most fun people to be there. You know, when you cover the White House for the first time, which I was doing at Bloomberg, all of it is just sort of breathtaking. You know, having a pass that lets you just like waltz right in to the building is amazing. And just sitting in the press briefing room is kind of, you know, you're like, oh my gosh, I've got to pinch myself. And, you know, just not only just sort of seeing the president, but having these interactions and being able to kind of freely walk around the, you don't have full reign of the West Wing, but you do. There are some of the rooms that are very close to the Oval Office. Like sometimes if like the right number of doors happen to be open, you just can see right into the Oval. And that's like fascinating. And so Julie was just like so kind too. So you have this, somebody who has this like huge reputation, is really one of the senior reporters in that room, who's just like very kind to people like me who had just started. And I was just like, oh my gosh, you know. You know, you're always sort of like afraid to do the wrong thing when you start covering the White House, which I did a number of times.
I sent stories.
Yeah. Oh, definitely are. Yeah. I'm very kind to other White House reporters from my remembering the things that I've done wrong, including I think I ended up somehow, when you go into the Oval Office, the sort of cameras are on one side, so they have like free rein to, you know, you don't have a print reporter standing in the way, and then the print reporters are all sort of supposed to stay on this other side, and nobody tells you that ahead of time because nobody wants to tell you like where to stand. And I walked in the first time and just ended up in front of all of the cameras, and they were like yelling at me to get down. So then I was like, I had to like kneel on the ground, which is going to sound terrible. And then I like the president of the United States walks in, and I'm just like, this is just such a bad look. Like, this is terrible. And I had to like shout questions from me. And I was just like, I felt so terrible. And then somebody like grabbed me afterwards, and they were like, that was really bad. You should not be like kneeling on the ground. Oh. And I was like, I didn't know what to do. And I was like, oh, I remember just feeling just awful. It was just awful. So I think that was my very first time in the Oval Office, and I'm very glad there's not a photograph of it. I have to tell you, I felt really badly for Kellyanne Conway when that like kneeling picture came out.
Oh, on the sofa.
I was just like, yeah. On the sofa, I was just like, oh, I know exactly what happened.
I know
there.
How you feel.
It's not what it looks. I know how you feel. Thank God there's not a picture of my version of it. So, oh,
fun.
Yeah, it's good, fun times.
I had another question for you too.
Yeah.
Was it a complete coincidence that you ended up with a partially being a sailing column writer, or do you actually love sailing?
Oh yeah, I'm a sailor. Yeah, some managing editor at the Sun realized that I was a sailor, and they're like, oh, we'd love to have a sailing column. And it was great. It was really great. Like, so I think it was like 3 times a week I would write this column about sailing. But yeah, I grew up in Connecticut on the water, and, you know, raced these little sailboats growing up and through college. And sometimes even here in Washington, if I can do it, I'll get out on the Anacostia and sail and race.
And sail and race.
Yeah. We race down here. There's a DC sail group right by the National Stadium. And we've got these little like 14-foot dinghies that will go out on. And there are a few regattas every year. Sean Spicer actually won it one year. He's a really good sailor. So there's a few. There's Molly Ball, another one of
yeah.
One of your favorites, the reporter at Time. She's a very good sailor. Although she hasn't raced, I've been trying to get her out. She hasn't done it yet.
See, we learned about the softball team. We had no idea about the sailing teams.
Yeah. There's a small but committed group of sailors in this town.
What is it that you love about sailing?
Have you ever gone sailing?
I have gone sailing, and I have to admit that I was both fascinated and at the same time overwhelmed.
Oh no.
There was a lot of things going on. Masts were going places where I didn't necessarily expect them. I had a bit of the same situation that you had with the press corps when you were crouching down.
Oh, God.
So
yeah.
I felt like I was always in the wrong place, doing the wrong thing and leaning the wrong way.
Oh yeah. Well, see, like much like my experience in the Oval Office, like you can figure it out after like an awkward beginning. You can work it out. But I just love being on the water, and I love, like, I know how to do it. So I've done it since I was like you know, tiny little girl. So it's like, so like, I don't even have to think about it. Like I immediately have a sense for where the wind is coming from and like what the tide is doing and like how far I can push a certain boat in a certain way. And so there's just like so much joy for me and like being on the water, but also like being able to propel myself and just having that kind of complete control over nature. And well, you're never totally controlling it, but you're using it in this way to get to where you want to go. And it's a really kind of freeing feeling. And I think I just, you, when you're racing a sailboat, you have to focus so intensely on what the other boats are doing and what the course is doing and what, you know, wind shifts are coming down, and you just really forget about literally everything else that's going on. You know, I can go sailing and race for a couple of hours and I come back and it's just like part of my brain is exhausted, but the part of my brain that had previously been exhausted feels very refreshed.
We've been talking to reporters about that. What do you do in order to turn things off? And I think we found Annie's thing to turn things off.
I do. I don't think at all about politics or politicians or Washington or the Hill or anything like that when I'm on a sailboat. Mm-hmm. Just getting from point A to point B as fast as possible.
So, recommendation to our listeners, if there's a sailable area near you, if there's anything water related near you, try sailing for a change instead of Twitter, and maybe you might feel better.
Yeah, that's true. I don't think about Twitter either.
Probably nobody should, to be honest.
Do you
remember when that whole Twitter thing actually came into your life? What do you make
of
Twitter?
I do. I joined Twitter during the Arab Spring. I remember specifically when I did. I remember thinking it was kind of dumb and not thinking this was just thinking it was like another ridiculous fad. But then during the Arab Spring, I remember reading about how people were using Twitter to warn each other about different government actions, and these activists were using it. And it was part of what helped overturn government. And so at that point, I remember thinking, wow, I mean, maybe I need to be less dismissive of this thing because it's being used to overturn government. So it's probably pretty powerful. So that's when I started using it. And I think really early on, I think I was when same-sex marriage was being debated in the Maryland State House, I went and covered one of the like subcommittee hearings, which like isn't a big deal in the overarching, you know, path of the same-sex marriage legislation, but it was actually very important in the moment. And so I was live tweeting the votes as they were going. And, you know, there's a very small but interested core of people who were watching. And afterwards, the governor's legislative aide came over to me and said, like, oh, you know, the governor at the time was following your Twitter feed because he you were tweeting faster than I was telling him what the votes were. And so he just wanted to let you know that he was following it. And I was like, oh my gosh, that was like such a big deal. So it was like I was being like a live news service. But I think it's really changed. I mean, there was a time when I think it was a little bit more fun than it is now. Like it can be, people get so outraged and like, you know, some of the outrage is just a little tiresome. I mean, how can you call yourself a journalist if you can tweet something like that? I mean, you're just like, come on, people. Like, let's just take it down a big notch. It's usually how I feel when that happens. Although I've discovered the mute button on Twitter. It's great.
So helpful.
It's like, I just mute people all the time. It's the best thing.
Intensely satisfying.
It's intensely, it's great. It's like, it's all gone. You would just hit mute and they don't even know they're muted. That's what I love about it. You just immediately forget about that person and you don't see any of the stuff they're saying. And they're basically just, they weren't in your life to start off with. They popped up to just be extremely rude and now they're just gone again. It's like, it's amazing. So
the power of the mute button.
The power of the mute button is my favorite.
Annie, we've kept you for a long time. We've kept you a little bit over the hour, even that.
Hopefully your listeners were not hitting mute.
No, of course. No, they would love for this to be 2 hours long, but I'm not going to do that to you. That would be extremely unfair. Do you have anything coming up? Do you have anything coming up? Asks the guy who was just told that you're totally on the front page of the Washington Post today. Do you have anything else coming out?
Oh, well, there is a story I'm working on this week, but I can't talk about it yet because it's in the sort of beginning phases of reporting, but I'm sure your listeners will all be our good Washington Post readers, and we'll get to see what I'm working on. And I'm going to be on I'll be out on the campaign trail a lot. So following a number of these candidates as they go on this very, very exciting and very long journey to November of 2020.
It is going to be a lot, but you sound incredibly fresh.
Annie, oh, good.
I have to say, you sound so fresh and energetic that it's almost throwing me off a little bit. I was expecting maybe a little bit of tiredness or some ennui, and there's just nothing. Just excitement.
The field is great. It's so much fun to have such a big field. I mean, it's so much fun. It's just like people, there are so many different ideas. And if you get like slightly annoyed or tired of one campaign, you can just like focus on another one for a little while. Well, your irritation washes away, and then just people have so many new ideas, and that's what's really fun about it, particularly this part of it. It's just like there's lots of ideas out there.
Do you feel like people are already fully engaged in this thing, or is it currently still the super fans that are paying attention and the rest is sort of tweeting this out until TV and it's so soon though. It's with the end of June, right?
I think people are pretty engaged. I feel like people are pretty engaged, you know? I mean, maybe it's just going to keep growing, but I do feel like people are pretty engaged, especially in the early states. But everywhere, you know, I went to Ohio and there were tons of people who were coming out to events. So it feels like people are pretty engaged.
Well, you know, our listeners are going to be super engaged. You've been extremely engaging. So thank you so much for today's interview.
Yeah, thank you.
And everybody who does not, for some inexplicable and inexcusable reason, is not already following Annie, you're going to follow her on Twitter at Annie Linsky. Make sure she doesn't mute you, so behave. And Annie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Talk to you next time.
Bye.